Any one of a number of news stories recently have pointed out that even if we were successful in bringing many American manufacturing functions back to the United States, well, they would not necessarily bring back many American jobs because so much of manufacturing is done by machines now, automation, machines, robots doing the work specified by computers. Take a lot of the mundane work on the assembly line now where people used to do the jobs. And it's not just the blue-collar jobs because lots of white-collar jobs are in the process of being converted to automation as well. Given that, what do we do with our own futures if we think that the job we're currently doing is something that could potentially be done by a smart machine? Well, this is what Edward Hess addresses in his book, Humility is the New Smart, Rethinking Human Excellence in the Smart Machine Age. The essence of it is that there are some things we do better as humans than machines can ever do. So let's emphasize that. Edward Hess spent a couple of decades as a business executive and some more time in academia. He's currently a professor of business administration at the University of Virginia. His research and books, there are 12 others, focus on how organizations and individuals can consistently perform at high levels. Catherine Ludwig, listed as second author, is a research, editing, and publishing associate at the University of Virginia. We welcome Edward Hess. Thanks for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thank you for having me, Jeffrey.
Interesting choice of for a title. Instead of How to Work with Robots, you lead with humility. Why?
Because humility is the gateway to being able to think differently than smart machines are going to be able to think, and humility is the gateway to high emotional engagement with other human beings. If you're full of yourself and consumed by yourself and always have to be right and correct, you're not going to be the type of thinker that's going to think differently than a smart machine, and you're not going to be the type of person that's going to be able to connect and build positive regard and trust with other human beings. The jobs that the technology is not going to be able to do well is the higher order thinking, critical thinking, innovative thinking, and creativity. And jobs that require high emotional engagement with other human beings and rendering customized services to them. And those types of, if you will, jobs require a quiet ego, which allows you to have an open mind, allows you to better perceive reality, test your thinking, be challenged about your thinking, and to learn, and to constantly learn and upgrade your skills, because you're not identifying yourself with how much you know or what you know, and you're working to tamp down your ego and your emotional defensiveness.
Quiet ego can also be a quiet mouth, I notice, the way you set things up in the book. I mean, people need to have better listening skills than speaking skills fairly often to be good at some of these higher order things you're talking about.
Absolutely, Jeffrey. Reflective listening is a necessity because each of us basically have our stories of how the world works. That's called mental models. But they're not reality. They're just our stories based on how we've experienced the world. And we're sort of wired, and I put quotes around wired, we're wired to be reflexive confirmation seekers. We basically only process information from the outside world if it agrees with what we already believe. That's the general rule. We're also emotionally defensive thinkers because we're seeking to affirm our egos, if you will. Well, in order to overcome that and be open to different ideas, to be open to having your ideas challenged and listening to new facts, you've got to truly listen to somebody and understand what they're saying. And most people listen to confirm. Most people view listening as competition. Most people view listening as transactional. But reflective listening means I'm going to listen to you with an open mind. I'm going to be fully present. I'm not going to be making up my answer in my mind while you're talking. And when you're through talking, I'm not going to tell you automatically either why you're wrong or what I believe and why I'm right. I'm going to ask you questions to understand what you truly believe, and then I'm going to reflect on that, and I'm going to basically respond thoughtfully. It's all about slowing down. The book is all about slowing down to think, slowing down to manage your emotions, slowing down to listen. And the book is all about choices. We have hundreds and hundreds of micro choices every day as to how we behave. And in order to outthink or think differently than a machine, you're going to have to slow down and be very cognizant of making the right choices about how you think, how you listen, how you engage with other human beings.
So our benefit then as humans is, we can't outdo a machine potentially in data storage or in the number of widgets we can assemble in an hour, but in terms of the things that we excel at in humanity, essentially, is what you're saying we should be emphasizing.
That's correct. That's what we should be emphasizing, and then we need to accept the science, which says We're not naturally good at those things, Jeffrey. Therefore, we need to have a program of self-improvement. And that's what the book puts forth, how to train like a champion, how to basically train yourself to manage your thinking, to manage your emotions, to connect and relate to people, to listen the best way. And it's very practical, applied with checklists, with questions, and a diagnostic for anybody that takes the diagnostic, which you can go and see, okay, what do I need to work on? Because underlying the skills that you're going to have to do are those basic behaviors, those the quiet ego, the managing your thinking emotions, the reflective listening, and being able to connect and relate to other people in a way that builds trust. Because most work that's going to be done by humans is going to be done in teams, because no individual can think at their highest level by themselves.
We did talk to the authors of that book recently who talked about how we do think better in pairs and in larger groups. So we've certainly got something to back you up there. There's a great phrase here early in the book that we should embrace the magnitude of our ignorance. What does that mean, Edward?
There's a lot more out there that we don't know than we do know. And we tend to form broad generalizations based on very little data. In fact, I'll give you a perfect example. My wife's a scientist, and we were having a conversation the other night, and I made a generalization. And she asked me, how many data points do you have? And I said, 2. She says, do you think you have enough data to make that broad generalization? I said, no. That's how humans generally think. And so the concept is that be aware of the magnitude of the ignorance in its. And everyone has a great magnitude of interest, and be a lifelong learner and have a process to continually learn.
Know that you don't know is a good way to proceed ahead. We're talking to Edward Hess about his book, Humility is the New Smart, Rethinking Human Excellence in the Smart Machine Age. Obviously, there are things that machines can do better than we can do, but there are lots of things that we can do better than computers, like be human among them. We'll get further into the specifics of this as we talk more with Edward Hess in the next segment. You can join us by phone or by email. We'll be back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to Edward D. Hess at the University of Virginia School of Business, where he's a professor of business administration. He's written a book with Catherine Ludwig called Humility is the New Smart, Rethinking Human Excellence in the Smart Machine Age, in which we think about not just the jobs that robots and computers can take away from us, but think about the things that we can do better than robots and computers because they can't be human. They don't have the higher level thinking skills that we do. Your thoughts, your comments, your questions are welcome on the Exchange at 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Your title echoes Norbert Wiener speaking in the late 40s. What did he say, Edward?
He basically said we can either be consumed by the smart technology and the robots, or we can adapt. And I think that's what we're talking about here, is what we as individuals need to do in order to adapt.
So are you at all daunted by the thought that there are so many things that computers and robots can do well that there won't be much left for people?
Well, the research is sort of frightening. The research, best research out there says in the next 5 to 15 years, about 47% of the jobs in the United States will be automated, including service jobs and the professional jobs. So this is a global problem. And the numbers in China are like 77%. The numbers in India, 69%. Europe, 57%. So, yes, there's a major transformation coming. The smart machine age, I believe, is going to be as or more disruptive as the Industrial Revolution was for our ancestors. And we are not having conversations in our country as to how we're going to adapt and adjust to it, what is going to be the future of work when a lot of people are not going to have full-time jobs, and how are we as a society are going to adapt to it. There's many people that are very concerned about this, that people in technology and people in academia speaking out about it. And so, yes, this is big, and this is, and some people have said, well, not to worry, we'll produce all the jobs we need just like we did in the Industrial Revolution. And I'm skeptical of that for two reasons, because if you study English history, you see in Great Britain, when the Industrial Revolution hit, it took 60 to 80 years for the country to adjust and for human misery to basically be abated. 60 to 80 years is a long time in the world we're living in today. The second thing is that it's different this time, Jeffrey, is we got to answer the question, will the new jobs be jobs that technology itself cannot do? Because technology is going to continue to advance. There are people working in technology that believe that there is a very high probability in the next decade or two they will produce artificial emotional intelligence, that smart machines will be able to be creative, will be able to paint, write, okay? And so technology is going to continue to advance. So therefore, the question is, will we produce enough jobs that technology can't itself do? That's why this is such a big, important issue to begin having a conversation about. I say in the book that it's like the Paul Revere ride. It's not the British that's coming. It's the smart machines are coming. And we need to basically start having conversations about what type of society we're going to be. We need to reform our school system. We need to be confronting the fact that work is going to change in our society.
Let's go there first with the school system. You've already identified the four skills you think we are good at and should focus on: critical thinking, innovative thinking, creativity, and high emotional engagement. Are we missing something by focusing on STEM skills too much?
STEM skills are, if you will, from a biology viewpoint and the science and the technology, yes, you cannot focus on those exclusively. You got to focus also on emotional intelligence and social intelligence and the how-to skills, the how to make things and how to do experiments and to how to think. So, yes, the answer is you've got to have both. The best education is an education where you're getting some science and some technology, and you're learning how to think in the ways that the machines can't think, and you're learning how to collaborate and work in teams and listen and have meaningful engagements with other people. So it's not an or anymore. It is an and. Now, if you had to choose, it would be, and if you can't do both, the key thing is, what does it take to become a lifelong learner? Because you're going to constantly have to upgrade your skills or retrain your skills as we go along, and those are back to, you're going to have some science in there, because that's how you learn how to do experiments. That's how you learn to have a way to go into the unknown and learn. If you remember when you were a child, or your children, or people that have grandchildren, remember when a kids are 4 or 5 years old, think about what kids do. They ask why, they try things, they fall down, they get up, and they try again. They're curious, fearless, and they have learning resiliency. That is schooled out of us in our country right now by our school system, and it needs to come back. It needs to basic children should never lose that, and those of us adults who have lost it have got to regain it, because whatever we prepare ourselves for the next 3 or 4 years, it's very likely that you're going to have to continually upgrade your skills the rest of your life to stay gainfully employed.
Edward Hess is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book with Catherine Ludwig is Humility is the New Smart, Rethinking Human Excellence in the Smart Machine Age, how we capitalize on the things that we can do better than machines, and that's namely by being human. and power that into the future. Join us at the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. You were talking about how the school system has trained some skills out of us, and I think what you said was resiliency. But to get further than that, though, you do say in the book that we need to be able to learn from our mistakes better than we do now.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you think about it, when I went to school, and I don't know about you, but probably when you went to school, think about who were the smart kids, and think about, go back to elementary school when somebody was designated smart. You know, the kids that made the highest test scores, and you generally made the highest test scores by memorizing stuff, and, you know, making mistakes was bad. Well, in the world we're entering into, mistakes are learning opportunities so long as they're not unethical, and so long as you're not harming somebody, so long as you're not spending all your money, wasting your money, or, you know, doing anything criminal. The mistakes are necessary if you're going to be a good critical thinker, innovative thinking, creative thinker, because it's all iteratively learning. It's all doing experiments. I go into the unknown just like a young child. I try something. Ouch. My finger's burnt on the oven, on the stovetop. Get my finger away. Did I learn something? Don't touch the stovetop. Okay, can I touch this? Yes. That type of process is what we humans are going to basically be doing the rest of our life with the smart technology. And so the answer is, and this is the book, we have another concept in the book called New Smart. New Smart says, don't get your ego wrapped up in what you know or how much you know, because the technology's always going to know more than you. Define yourself by the quality of your thinking, listening, relating, and collaborating. Change the definition of smart from a quantity, I know more than you, to a quality. It changes from being having to be the person that's always right and not being wrong to the person that's trying to be the most accurate. That enables, if you will, lifelong learning, and that enables you to be open-minded and to seek out information which disagrees with what you believe, so you can modify what you believe so you can be more accurate. The people who have the best skills at continually becoming more accurate and adapting and being agile are the people that are going to do well in the new era.
So it's really about being a master of synthesizing the intangible, being able to figure out things that are not even necessarily hard facts, but particularly where emotional intelligence is concerned, figuring out ways to navigate between personalities on a team so that you work better together.
Correct. Right on, Jeffrey. Correct. And to be able to manage your emotions, to be able to label them, to be able to, you know, if you will, control them, but also to be aware of the other person's emotions so you can basically react in an appropriate way, because the quality of the team output all comes down to the level of trust between people. And no longer is it competition, it's collaboration. No longer is it the big me, it's going to be the big we. Going forward, the biggest competition I'm going to have, you're going to have, and anyone listening is going to have, is not someone else. It's ourselves. My biggest competition is me. I have to continue my work of trying to take my thinking, listening, and collaborating skills to a higher level. And I've got to get that right. And I've got all the, and all of us have all the work we can handle without worrying about whether I'm better than somebody else.
Edward Hess, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book of Humility is The New Smart, Rethinking Human Excellence in the Smart Machine Age. Here's a call from Daniel in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Exchange.
Hi, Jeffrey and Edward. I wanted to speak to an area that doesn't really need machines, but that's going to be the political sphere, where we really, most of us see right now, a divide that's so strong. The prejudgments that come to any policy meeting seem to be, they are wrong and I am right. And we know we got to get over this in order to get to a fuller understanding of what's really workable. Anyway, I wanted to find out, what have we got as citizens as an avenue to promote exchange, looking for accuracy rather than ideology in the political anyway, to get us out of this morass that we're in, stuck and going nowhere, and no chances of moving anywhere successfully soon.
All right. That's a good question. Thanks for that, Daniel. Appreciate it. Edward, your thoughts?
That is a good question, Daniel. And we are stuck in a dysfunctional phase, and it's going to take leadership. It's going to take leadership. I think it's going to take leadership from the voters, the people. I think it's going to take leadership from other parts of our society, religious leadership, educational leadership, business leadership. And there needs to be a movement which is basically saying, we, with what's coming in the challenges that we face as a country, and there are many challenges that face the country, we need to be having different types of conversations about who we want to be as a society and how we're going to, if you will, regain what was part of this country in the era 1947 to 1977, which was the era of great prosperity, the 30-year period where everybody who was working shared in the prosperity, and it was the best economic time in U.S. history, and where people were working together, and everyone was, was sharing, prospering. They worked hard. We're talking about the jobs. So, yes, and it has to come from leadership, but it also has to come, I believe, from people like you, Daniel. I think that the more people that can go into their community meetings and band together and say, look, we've got these problems and we need to start solving them, and we want to volunteer and other people want to volunteer, and we want our elected officials, we want to hold them accountable. It's a big issue, because in the country today, the conversations are being had in Europe and Canada and Australia and China and New Zealand about what's coming with technology. We're not having any serious conversation in our country about this, and it's going to hit us very hard, and we need to have these conversations. You're quite correct, sir.
Daniel identified the issue as a state of I'm right and you're wrong, and I wonder if I can extrapolate from your constant focus in the book on the stripping away of ego that maybe what needs to be said is, I might be wrong.
That's right. I might be wrong. Or what's even better to be said is, I don't know. there's a lot of people that take positions and they really don't know. And you're right. I may be wrong. Or, this is what I believe. What do you think? Where do you, why do you disagree? And too many people talk without slowing down to think. What do I believe? Why do I believe it? What is it based on? Do I have enough facts? Are they credible facts? What could make my belief wrong? Have I looked for those facts? Too many people don't have a process for even understanding why they believe what they believe. This whole thing about ego is so big in our country, and that's why we chose the title Humility. And unfortunately, you look in the dictionary, and humility means meekness, submissiveness, thinking lowly of yourself. But that's not what humility is from a psychological viewpoint. Humility is having an accurate view of your abilities, your achievements, the ability to acknowledge one's lack of knowledge, your ignorance, being open to new ideas, contradictory information, actually evaluating it, thinking, keeping your accomplishments in perspective. You're right. The big me issue, and the divisiveness, and the I'm right and you're wrong, and the competition is part of the cultural change that the book talks about. We're going to have to go back to the big we.
So,
not the big me.
All right. So that, there's a whole chapter in the book, Edward, on quieting ego. What kinds of practices get us there?
That's a very good question. One of the best practices that get us to quiet ego is one to slow down. But is meditation. The science, neuroscience on meditation says that if you do up to say 10 minutes of meditating a day and train your mind to basically grasp on to everything flowing through your mind, but to train your mind to come back to be attentive. That has impact on you physically and neurologically. It does quiet the ego. The other thing that the science says it works is acts of gratitude. Every day sitting back and thinking about, wow, who helped me today, or who helped me get here, and either thanking people, writing people note, remembering them in ways that you choose to remember them. But acts of gratitude basically help you understand that I didn't get where I am, and it's not just me. People are helping me. And then who am I helping? How am I paying back, so to speak? And so the two best ways that the science at this point says is meditation and mindfulness and gratitude.
Mindfulness and gratitude, which perhaps could get us to a place where with less ego we can get to the situation you talked about a few moments ago about common good versus individual greed. I don't think you used the term greed, but it does show up later in the materials that came with the book. Is there a point, you think, if smart machines take away a lot of jobs, do we get to a point where people actually work a lot less? I mean, it's been theorized by the likes of John Kenneth Galbraith for most of a century now that perhaps we could work 20 hours a week instead of 40, and that would be good.
The answer is yes. That's a likelihood. That is a likelihood. And that will be different, and then people will have time, hopefully, to... Now, we're assuming that they'll be able to earn a livelihood, okay, and have a quality of life and have dignity and meaning. But then people will have time to spend time on other pursuits, and that may be their family, it may be their hobbies, it may be their religious activities, it may be further education. But yes, that is a distinct possibility that work week may get shorter, and there's a distinct possibility that there may be a group of us that are basically don't have what we call a job, but we're going from gig to gig or independent contracting or finding things. And if you think about it, go back to the hunter-gatherer days, our ancestors, you know, where community becomes more important. And, you know, maybe Jeffrey, I'll grow vegetables and fruits and you'll raise chickens or whatever, and we'll swap. And that we, you know, we go back and take care of the land and live off the land and find meaning.
That could be a lot of options in this future. And it's not a very huge book, but it certainly is quite thought-provoking. It's called Humility is the New Smart, Rethinking Human Excellence in the Smart Machine Age. Edward Hess, the primary author, with Catherine Ludwig. He's at the University of Virginia. Thanks so much for joining us today. Very much appreciate your time.
Thank you, Jeffrey, for having me. I enjoyed the conversation.